Welcome back, beloved listeners, to more of Late Night Live on RN Summer. In the past, I've described the guests that we have on the program tonight as one of those Australians who make life worth living, and I was talking about Don Watson, whose career in writing has spanned 40 years and has done so much to hold a mirror up to ourselves as a nation, with Don's incisive political, historical and linguistic observations. He began his professional life as an academic historian. Who could forget his musical, Manning Clark the Musical, although I suspect that sometimes Don wishes we could forget it. He wrote wonderful stuff for Max Gillies before becoming Premier, before becoming speechwriter to our mutual friend John Cain, and then, of course, famously, Prime Minister Keating's speechwriter. Don's the award-winning author of 13 books, including Recollections of a Bleeding Heart, A Portrait of Paul Keating, and The Bush, Travels into the Heart of Australia. And I think that was the last time that Don was on the program when we were discussing that splendid tome. His latest covers the gamut. It's wise, it's witty, and I reckon essential reading at this point in time. As the book jacket correctly says, no other writer has journeyed further into the soul of Australia and returned to tell the tale. And let us also remember he's pretty good at the soul of the United States as well. Watsonia, A Writing Life, is an impressive collection of his essays and articles published over the last 40 years. And Don, welcome back to the Little Wireless Program.
Well, thank you, Philip.
I want to start off by reading the first paragraph in your introduction. I never set out to be a writer, but drifted into it. In a different time, in my father's day, for instance, I might have ended up a swagman. As a boy, I briefly fancied the Navy, but that lasted no longer than my religious phase. My plans for a career as a travelling salesman or a detective can be put down to teenage hormonal imbalance. The derangement passed eventually, but the urge to wander lingered. You keep pushing this line that you never wanted to be a writer, and then you're almost a writer, a reluctant writer.
Yes, well, I am. I suppose I didn't do anything else very well. And, you know, it was the 1970s, so there were academic... You suddenly realised that you'd become an academic. You were a dairy farmer's boy, and then the next minute you were an academic of some kind. And then you had a PhD, and so you became a lecturer in whatever. And then in 1982 or 3, I thought, I don't want to do this anymore. And I never intended to do it, so I went freelance to write mainly for Max Gillies.
You just tossed aside the fact that you did a PhD. Might I ask in what?
Well, I wrote a biography of Brian Fitzpatrick.
Ah, well, of course, a mutual friend. Wonderful. And he was very influential in your life, wasn't he?
He was indeed. And I hadn't really, as usual, it just passed me by. But then I went to a seminar about, I don't know, 25 years ago or more, and someone said to me, you know, Fitzpatrick was really your teacher. I'd never met him, of course. He was dead before I turned up in Melbourne. And and I thought about it later and thought, well, in a way he was. And he, of course, was a freelance for most of his life, well, all of it really, a sort of maverick freelancer, bohemian socialist, drinker, many things, publicist. One-man show, a sort of I.F. Stone of Melbourne or a Claude Coburn, someone.
I remember him famously knocking on the door at ASIO and demanding to see his file. They were so nonplussed they didn't even have a look at it, and he went through it and corrected the errors.
Yes, he was an amazing character, and I was very lucky to get his papers, and I wrote the PhD or most of it in his old room in Clendon Road, Toorak, courtesy of his widow Dorothy, who let me in there. So it was, you know, as it was like being sitting in his chair, really, and literally I was. And I have a feeling he was a sort of, I think I say, if not a surrogate father, a sort of renegade uncle. and you know, and I think I might have followed mainly unconsciously, but maybe with a bit more direction than that, into his footsteps.
You write that although you're a socialist of sorts, and I quote, my behaviour lent less support to revolutionary theory than to Oscar Wilde's belief that socialism, I'm sorry, it's just so damn funny, that Oscar Wilde's belief that socialism was doomed to failure because people would not be willing to give up their evenings.
Oscar said some wonderful things. I don't think anything true was ever said about political commitment.
Oh, dear. Okay, so you make the point that you never sort of known what sort of writer you are, but you would claim to have learnt what kind of writer you're not, and you say you're not brave, not hardy enough to be a frontline journalist like Robert Fisk, and you say you can't take yourself seriously enough to write novels.
Yes, I write them in my head. I've got two in my head nearly all the time. When I'm sitting there waiting for the children to go to sleep, I write another chapter. Then I come back and I can't remember what it was. Now, I'd love to have written fiction. I wrote a few films, and that's a marvellous thing to do until it comes to the time to make them.
Wasn't there, I'm trying to remember that wonderful film with Billy Connolly in.
Yeah, The Man Who Sued God.
Yes, yes, that was fun.
Which, like most films, had a long history. You know, it was someone had the original idea that a person would sue an insurance company for failing to pay on an insurance claim because it was an act of God. And then John Clark wrote a script which didn't satisfy the producers, and so I was brought on after that. And it was made with Billy and Judy Davis and Colin Friels. It was, you know, it was fun. You know about films. They never.
I haven't seen the thing for decades, but I enjoyed it enormously.
Yeah, it never turned
to time. Yeah.
Imagines, but it was good. Another film, it was about Percy Grainger with Richard Roxburgh.
I'd forgotten that.
Yeah, good,
a fine performance and one of our more fascinating Australians.
Yeah, yeah. But the best, I never thought that the best film scripts I wrote were the ones that were made. I'm sure there are other film writers who feel the same way.
You say that your rural childhood in Victoria was laced with irony. Quote, the irony that's inevitable when human ambition meets implacable nature. So you've been drawn to it your entire life, in history, literature, politics?
Yes, I think too much. I mean, I think I went through a phase in the 80s where I was, you know, everyone was into comedy in the 80s. You know, there was the Gillies Report, and then that was followed by the people who ended up making Frontline, and is that what it was called? Yeah. I think Michael Luning drew a cartoon about how everyone gave up whatever they were doing. It was serious, they gave up to become comedians. And I think Australians are probably a little over-ironic sometimes, but well, they look for it everywhere. But it's hard to escape in this country, you know. When you have Burke and Wills as your two and if you grow up on Steel Rudd, you know, which is just heavy with it, you know, it's that business. The Americans went out and they found wherever they went, you know, they found the Mississippi, then they found the Columbia and the Mackenzie, and they found the other side, they found California and then the Pacific Ocean and the prairies before that and so on. We went out and we just found emptiness.
Well, not only did Steel Rudd, not only was Steel Rudd full of irony, so was the Sermon on the Mount. You point out Marx couldn't resist it, nor could Twain, Trotsky, Voltaire, Wilde, Balzac, all, and Camus. Is that right?
Well, I think they were all great tracts of irony. I don't know whether the Sermon on the Mount was, whether it was meant to be ironic, but, you know, blessed are the meek always seems to me.
Blessed are the cheesemakers. We remember that, of course, vividly. And you also see it in the writings of, say, Lawson and the Fortunes of Richard Marning.
Well, very much so, yes. I mean, it is an unmistakable thread through the national life. I don't know quite why that is. There were, there's a marvelous sort of seminal cartoon. I think it was an English cartoon of the convict sitting in a boat being rowed ashore at Sydney Cove by Marines, and the convict saying, "Row, you bastards, row."
Oh, dear. Now,
as sounding irony.
At the time you were writing for Gillies, of course, the incumbent PM offered limitless potential for send-ups. Yeah. Quote, "He was the Hawke Labor government deregulating the economy, stripping away protection, selling public assets. His treasurer cruised around in Zegna suits and had a taste for Marla and Ormond clocks. Labor's followers needed a contortionist to front them."
Yeah, that's right. And they found one. I mean, he was amazing material, Hawke. I mean, as the years have gone by, I've felt increasingly fond of him. I think he was essential to the, you know, to the country's development in a way.
Now, as a country boy, you're well qualified to talk about changes to rural Australia, the place where our so-called Australian traditional values really emerged. But there's clear evidence that rural Australia has changed. There's a little moment somewhere in the book where you're having your hair cut, and this triggers an emotional response from you.
Yes, I mean, it's a long while ago. I think it's the first piece I wrote for the Monthly, in the first edition of the Monthly. As I often have, I went for a big drive around for a couple of weeks, really, all over Victoria and parts of New South Wales. And I stopped for a haircut. I think it was in Horsham. And there were about 12 hairdressers in Horsham. And it was like all country towns. And it was something. And she said, you know how Australians say no worries?
Yeah.
The rising inflection, no worries. So it didn't really matter what you said that she was likely to respond, no worries. And she told me halfway through it that their farm, there was a fire burning rapidly towards her farm, but no worries, her husband was there and he'd put it out. It was a telling moment. The sort of bruising, tough country towns are a thing of the past, really. And I think it was then that I also noticed the habit of that the cafes would put out little homilies on blackboards for the day. I was sort of, you know, the sort of thing that Cicero might have done in Rome, how to lead your life, or Montaigne might have done.
I don't think they did it outside cafes, but I take your point. I was fascinated to realise, and it had never occurred to me, that almost everything that of significance in the country, in the bush, was built, in a sense, before World War II. You know, there was halls and libraries and mechanics institutes and post offices and churches and grandstands and railway stations, and almost nothing of significance or durability since.
That's right. They pulled down all the verandas in most of the towns, which was a really stupid thing to do because it kept the heat and the rain off. And they put up these horrible gimcrack things that we basically wrecked all these beautiful towns. There are still some in Victoria and quite a lot in New South Wales, which are rather beautiful. But it's that beauty which makes you think, why didn't they leave them all like this?
I remember going to Tasmania for the first time and suddenly realising it had been very fortunate in that it had been preserved by poverty.
Yeah. Well, there's a town in North Carolina called Asheville, which was preserved by poverty, and it's a kind of perfect Art Deco town. It's where Zelda Fitzgerald died, I think, in Asheville. It's one of those few towns in America which have survived.
I think we'll leave America for a little later in our conversation. Thank you very much, Mr. Watson. And you make the point that today the absence of substance, of any signs of an aesthetic, exemplifies an age, our own, the one ruled by market ideology and private taste, and that produces bad taste.
It does. There was another example of Girildry, and I don't know why they've done it, but apparently they've stopped it now, but they decided they would theme Girildry, which is in the Riverina, a town of about 1,200, 1,500 people, with Ned Kelly, because of course Ned went there with his gang and held up the town and robbed the place and wrote the famous Girildery letter. So they put tin cutouts of Girildery on every rooftop of Ned, which was strange, really, seeing he was a lawless character. And they, the police station is designed in a Ned shape.
Now, you're kidding. I've never seen that.
That's true. It was a Ned-themed police station. Well, he shot three of them. Would have shot a fourth and he escaped. And I thought it was odd because John Monash lived in Girildery, and you would have thought, well, you know, the city fathers would think, well, maybe John Monash is epic, so we have a statue to him. But no, let's do Ned.
Yeah, well, I know it. I live near Musselbrook, and there's a huge and particularly ugly statue of a dog. But someone suggested the blue heeler was, you know, saw its first origins in the town. But there's not a hint that Donald Horne ever lived there. We do tend to sort of be dismissive of our significant cultural figures. The culture wars, I know you're tired of them, but I'd like you to talk to them briefly. You make the point that it seemed the country couldn't live without the organising principles of the Cold War. The philosopher R.G. Collingwood.
Caught us by surprise. But you mentioned the musical earlier, that I may have been aware of the culture wars coming to us, but I wasn't really. I don't think I was. And then the morning after the Manning Clark musical opened, the Herald Sun devoted the first five pages of its of that edition to tearing us limb from limb. The most ferocious attack. The Herald followed up, the Evening Herald followed up a few weeks later, and it was the most, you know, we were accused of the most terrible things. And I mean, the show was not what Tim Robertson and I and John Ronald intended it to be. That was just the way things fell out. It was, you know, it was meant to be a much more radical show. It was meant to be like any Ariana Mnuchin's 1789, all done in the round, and it ended up in a proscenium arch in an air-conditioned theatre, you know, in a heat wave. But anyway, it was a jolly sort of a show. You know, Bob Hawke was sitting in front of me, laughed away. Everyone laughed. We got a standing ovation, but I remember. Was it one of those standing ovations where you thought, this isn't going to last?
Well, you didn't get one in the Herald. But, of course, Manning Clark was pursued beyond the grave in the culture wars, wasn't he?
It was the most bizarre thing. I mean, the idea of Manning as a Marxist-Leninist, I mean, would certainly make Brian Fitzpatrick roll around laugh.
And, of course, according to some, he won the Lenin Prize, didn't he? It was all a big secret.
It was quite astonishing. I mean, the beard was meant to be a Lenin beard and all this. But, you know, there are lots of places that, lots of ways of, you know, criticising Manning for his history and whatever else you like, but the sort of going after him as a kind of communist spy, and it went on for years. And I thought the rather disgraceful thing was that only a few historians defended him. I thought academia didn't distinguish itself, because it was an attack on Clark, as if history is not a contestable thing. Was an attack on, you know, the intellectual life of the country, and no one, with two or three honourable exceptions, stood.
Don, the ABC is forever a part of our culture wars. Regular listeners will remember that we previously discussed Keith Murdoch's campaign against the very notion of an independent ABC news service back in 1947, citing familiar themes, unfair competition. It would create for his newspapers, and on it goes. Back in 2014, you wondered where the heck the conservative obsession with the ABC stemmed from.
Yes, and I still wonder, really. I think the way the only way to get to a sort of answer to this is to recognize that then to stop using the word conservative, because I mean, I'm more conservative by far than most of these people who go under that rubric. They are actually radical right reactionaries, if you like. There's nothing conservative about them at all. See, I can understand some of them who've come out of the Cold War days when they fiercely defended what they saw as an anti-communist position, and that seems to me a perfectly reasonable and honourable position. But now it's this ferocious personal hostility to virtually anyone who is of liberal belief. It was possible to be an anti-communist liberal once, but now it's liberals themselves are the devil. Why you should have this sort of collection of opinions, which includes not believing in science, like climate science.
You're listening to Late Night Live on RN Summer, where you can download, listen and share your favourite LNL interviews on the ABC Listen app. And today I'm talking to the very downloadable Don Watson, author of Watsonia, A Writing Life. So, okay, let's switch to the US. You spent a long time there and you admit you might have remained there, wandering, a sort of a swaggy of sorts, but for other concerns. Summarise its attractions. You say there's something inherently epic about it.
Yes, it's a hard one to do. But I think, for a start, it has to be recognised that there are many Americas, and they're all pushed up against one another. And to drive around the United States or even to walk through a train from one carriage to the next, you're likely to run into who knows which America it is you're going to see, except you always know if it's Texas because of their hats.
Surely that applies in Australia because of the Yacoubras.
Yes, no, the Texans wear those big hats and they have those little things that pull up in the throat, you know, those little
toggles. The bolo ties, I think they were called.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people, including many Americans, keep away from those people. But anyway, there's something sort of raw and primitive about much of America. And there's something fantastically familiar, and you realise how much you've imbibed of American popular culture through your life post-Second World War, because it's always a little bit familiar. You always feel a little bit like you've been there before. There's a bit of Alice in Wonderland about it, really. You'd drive along and you'd see, will I go up that road or will I go on down a bit further? And you think, well, if I went up that road, I might have had an adventure. And you'd generally be welcomed, although you might also be shot. And there is a sense of freedom in the United States that I've never quite felt here, because it feels a little bit dangerous. You know, that's what I think I mean by epic. And they've worked it over so much. You know, so much of it is they have mythologized in film and television and literature.
But that's why the place is so familiar to you. I remember writing again and again when I was, trying to get the idea of a film industry up and running, that we were more familiar with the streets of Los Angeles or with the streets of New York than we were with the streets of Sydney or Melbourne, at least when it came to the big screen or the little screen.
That's absolutely right. And we found that, of course, in the musical. You know, you put Alfred Deakin on and no one in the audience, apart from a couple of Australian history lecturers, would know who the hell it was. Whereas if you put Abraham Lincoln walking across the stage, they'd know who he was. And in the US, the founding fathers would all be remembered. You know, Hamilton.
And are in musicals to this day.
Exactly. We never were so familiar with anyone. I mean, I think it was in the social pages of that famous edition of The Sun, attacked us for having the cheek to depict Henry Lawson as a drunk. And you think, well, if you know anything about Henry Lawson, you know that he did put it away. And it's one of the tragedies of our national life. I mean, that's the interesting thing. I think one of the saddest moments in Australian life must have been when Mark Twain came to Australia and Henry Lawson went to hear him speak with his ear trumpet and he sat at the front. But there's no indication that Henry Lawson ever actually met Mark Twain. Henry was our Mark Twain. At his best, he was in that sort of realm. But Henry ended up a poor, pathetic wretch. And Twain, of course, you know, went to the grave, the world's most, as he used to describe himself, the world's most famous man, you know, and his a true icon of American life.
But there's something very appropriate about the dying cadence of Henry Lawson, because, as you say, our history is littered with monuments to failure, like, well, Burke and Wills, who you mentioned, even Gallipoli itself.
Yes, I don't know why that is, whether it's just happen chance or it's something in our bones. But it's a, you know, I think that's another problem in a way, that we try and mythologize. And, you know, nations need myths, and I rather like the fact that this nation's myths are not excessively heroic. But I the Americans, on the other hand, if you really are, they're several nations held together by myth, and they may not hold for much longer, I think.
When you were wandering around America, you witnessed its immense variety. We don't have that so much in Australia, do we?
No, this,
you know, why? I've never understood it. There is, you know, all the accents in America. There are comparatively few Australian accents.
That's right. The only place I think you could detect a real difference, I think, is probably Central and Western Queensland, where they say A at the end, you know. That's a red kangaroo, A.
I thought that was more an indigenous way of speaking.
No, they all talk like that, and it goes all the way back. There's a surveyor went out there in the 1880s and said, never in the world, he was English, had he heard anyone swear like they do out there. For no reason at all that he could see, but they just kept doing it, and they still do. I can't give you some examples on this program, Philip, but it's quite... They're quite a distinct lot, and they'll just be minding your own business, you know, in your motel room, and some bloke will put his head in the door and tell you about how to poison a dingo for about an hour and a half.
I want to take you back to about 2005 and your observations of the United States then, because they, what you observed then reached its apotheosis or its peak. Now, you know, in the Trump era, because you saw the good and the bad, but you saw the brute greed, the gross inequality, the patriotic belligerence, the crumbling infrastructure, the provincial ignorance, and the elite's ignorance of the provinces, the paranoia, the religious manias, etc., etc. I'm quoting, of course, from you.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I think there was. I went. There, my first longish trip that was about 2005. I went there after Katrina. Went to New Orleans about I don't know. I think 3 weeks or so after it, and it was rock bottom. He was a country that had just invaded Iraq, and Bush had appeared with mission accomplished and all this sort of stuff, and we'd seen the fireworks, what they could do to another country, and everyone was beating their hairy chests, but they couldn't do anything to look after these people in New Orleans. And it's funny, I went back about 3 years later, 2 or 3 years later, yeah, 3 years later, and I went out to the Ninth Ward, and the only houses that had been built in those 3 years to replace all the ones that had been washed away had been built by Brad Pitt and his wife,
We took the program there at the same time, and I also reported that paradox.
Extraordinary. These orange, brightly coloured houses, and there was a man sitting there in a new house, on his new balcony, directing these white people where to put the fridges and everything and everything. They put the television over there and the fridge there, and he'd been washed out of his top floor window with his wife attached to a piece of electrical cord. And he pointed to a tree that was still standing and said, we were in there for a day and a half. And then they helicoptered us out, and we spent 2 years in Dallas. He said, the wife quite liked Dallas, but now we're back here. We've got this house built. And Brad was down here yesterday, he said. And I said, it must seem like a little bit of a dream. You're lying in bed one night, and then 2.5 years later, you're back in a new house that Brad Pitt built. And he said, it is a bit of a dream, I suppose.
Only in America. I'm going back to that list of pathologies I quoted of yours earlier, the paranoia, the religious manias, the ugliness and the incessant lunatic shouting of Fox News and the mad dogs of the radio. Well, we see where that led us.
Yeah, it didn't get any better. And I mean, I guess that's the thing about the present calamity in the United States, is that the fault lines have been there for so long. In fact, they've always been there from the very beginning. And it only took one side to decide that they weren't going to share, they weren't going to reach across the aisle, that they weren't going to count out of the same myth, they weren't going to drink the same Kool-Aid, if you like, and everything falls apart. And, you know, you can blame all that part of America that exists between California and the East Coast, but you've also got to blame those East and West Coast liberals, who it seems to me have remained determinedly ignorant about what goes on in between. It's the part you fly over.
Yeah.
I think Obama failed badly. I think the Democrats failed to contest that ground. They left it to the Tea Party, and that was a disaster.
Now, let's talk about the guy who has been described as the designated mourner, Joe Biden, now billed as the healer. And that fits so well into your analysis of the Democrats in America needing a healer, someone to bridge the divides. Can the US be healed, Don?
Well, I think the only... I don't think Biden can do it. I think the healer has to come from the Republican side. It has to be some conservatives, who genuine conservatives, sort of Romneyite conservatives, who will say enough is enough and turn back. And
well, there's no sign of them doing it yet, Don.
No, and I'm not at all sure it's going to happen. I wrote a piece where I thought it was a bit like the man who shot Liberty Valance. If you think of James Stewart as the Democrat who goes to a showdown with Lee Marvin, who, you know, is a horrible, very bad person, think of him as Trump. And the Democrats right away thinking that Jimmy Stewart shot Lima, but of course we find out later it was the old rugged individualist John Wayne from behind a wall who actually shot him. And that's what you need. You need John Wayne to turn and say, enough's enough, I'm on the side of the Democrats.
Don, okay, how would you compare us today to the US? Where are we right now? You have said that in Australia it's not so much a case of what we've lost as what we've failed to gain.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. You can feel very frustrated about politics in this country. I mean, but at the same time you can't help thinking, well, it's not a bad place. I mean, we've just gone through a lockdown in Melbourne, and various, from the usual quarters, we've had people jumping up and down saying it's a terrible thing and all these faux libertarians and God knows what going on. But in the end, sort of common sense communitarianism prevailed, And now in Victoria, and for that matter, across the continent, we have so few cases of COVID compared to the United States and many other countries. You think, well, old-fashioned communitarianism is not a bad idea, you know, and that, and it seems that the whole country faced with that exercises its common sense. And so long as the country sort of follows a common sense pattern, whether it's in the hands of Liberals or Labor, there's never going to be that much to complain about.
I want to quote your observation of the current Prime Minister. At some point in any interview with the Prime Minister, one is liable to be reminded of a dung beetle. He starts with nothing much at all, and by unstoppable single-minded exertion, he pushes it through every interrogative thicket and every hurdle of logic and evidence until he's created a ball of bullshit several times his own size. Forget what he said at other times, what stunts he's pulled, ignore the fudges, ask not where consistency, truth and substance lie. He will drown out his doubters in a storm of platitudes and shameless demotic sores. What he says may be off the point, beside the point, or have no point at all, but sooner or later it becomes the point. I congratulate you. I wish I'd written that.
Yeah, well, it's that was written at the time of the fires, I think. And, that sort of marketing, that awful stuff we're fed all the time, and we know that it's not really spontaneous, except it's spontaneous marketing speak. All that stuff, I think, becomes very depressing after a while. And yet, you know, I think he's done a pretty good job on the COVID business, and I don't know whether anyone else would have done it any better. But I just wish we had political leaders of with some sort of philosophy underpinning it, with some sort of spontaneous ability to talk to us.
Well, how do we talk to people politically? Let's talk about our mutual friend Freudie Graham Freudenberg. You wrote a superb eulogy for him last year, describing as Labour's great articulator, its poet. And for 50 years, he wrote speeches for Labour. And you say his belief in Labour was unbreakable. It was, in fact, his church, and that he belongs in the national pantheon.
Yes, well, I think he does. He gave the country really words that lifted everybody a bit. He should certainly be in Labour's pantheon. But I think he belongs to the country at large.
People forget what a long run it was, you know, 50 years, for heaven's sake. I met him when we were both working on the Cornwall campaign. And even then, I mean, Arthur wasn't the most articulate of politicians. And here's Freudenberg trying to put wonderful words into Arthur's mouth.
Well, it's extraordinary because if you read that famous speech that Arthur made, which, you know, brought about his demise, but it was a brave speech just the same on Vietnam, you can actually, nothing else, I can hear Arthur Caldwell's voice in that speech, which says something about the genius of Graham Freudenberg. But he spans a long time. And I think it also has to be said that politicians were still using speeches in those days. The speech is sort of dying a terrible death. So if there are other Freudenbergs out there, they're not going to get much of a chance because politics is now run on messages and tweets and doorstops and, you know, the day's notes and all that stuff.
Don, I really must quote the Freudie's speech of Cornwall. I offer you the probability that you will be traduced, that your motives will be misrepresented, that your patriotism will be impugned, that your courage will be called into question. But I also offer you the sure and certain knowledge that we will be vindicated, that generations to come will record with gratitude that when a reckless government willfully endangered the security of this nation, the voice of the ALP was heard strong and clear on the side of sanity and in the cause of humanity and in the interests of Australia's security. Now, I think that's pretty damn good, but it reminds us, doesn't it, that if a Labor Party doesn't stand for high ideals, it's pretty much useless.
I think that's completely right, you know, and I think that's what they really struggled with really for a very long time now. And I reckon Labor should just take a deep breath, go away and walk around for a while and decide what it is they really believe in and say, well, this is where we stand, because until then they will be there'll be factional blues and they'll be messaging and the geniuses will be getting in the ears of the leaders and saying, this is what you've got to do. Don't say that. That'll get us into trouble further down the line and so on.
And yet from time to time in our collective memory, and certainly in your memory and mine, we've seen and heard some great speeches. You co-authored one, the famous Redfern speech. I think Rudd's apology speech was pretty damn good. And you make the point that Shorten's speech wanted for nothing, but people weren't listening.
No, I remember I watched that and I had this horrible feeling through that whole thing that no, it was a bit like watching, you know, a program about Mixmasters or something, you know, one of those kitchen shows that tells it that only a few people are watching, that it just was echoing the whole thing. See, all the days of the big policy launch and the big policy speech, all those things, are pretty well gone. And I don't know how you'd ever get them back. I mean, it's a bit like that with journalism, isn't it? You know, that there's no shortage of good journalists here and in the rest of the world, but the platforms for good journalism are now so limited that you end up talking to yourself, and you're certainly not talking to, you know, Western Queensland or the suburbs or pretty well anywhere.
You're listening to Late Night Live on RN Summer, where you can download, listen and share your favourite LNL interviews on the ABC Listen app. And today I'm talking to the very downloadable Don Watson, author of Watsonia, A Writing Life. By strange coincidence, I've been tweeting rather unpleasant things about Kim Beazley, who I think let the side down. He had a genius for concession speeches. But you argued back in 2003, with Beazley as leader, the Labor needed a philosophy, quote, nothing comprehensive, just a few sentences that reveal what it thinks about how things are now, as called it.
Yeah, I think that's quite right. I think that was, you know, that's the sort of tragedy of Labor, is that after Keating lost in 1996, if Labor had believed they were going to win, they would have won the next election. But they didn't. But it was
a cast
of advisors who didn't believe it was possible from the beginning, and so they didn't, you know. But a bit of belief would have carried them a long way.
Yeah. Well, of course, if we go back to Arthur, he lost that election, but that decision and that speech that I just read in part helped set up Labor for years.
Yeah, it did.
And Whitlam couldn't have happened without that.
No, it's quite true. I also think that Hawke and Keating couldn't have happened without Whitlam. That, in a way, the...
Don't think they'd agree.
No, I know they wouldn't, but I think it's true. I think they grew on the back of that, of Whitlam's demise, not only what he did, but then the way that he was brought down brought a lot of people into the party and with fire in their bellies. And they were determined, you know, that they weren't going to be accused of that, of the things that Whitlam was accused of, like incompetence with the economy. I think, you know, that I think the Hawke Keating years owed a lot to the Whitlam years.
I love the image of a man at an ALP function who stands up to ask, isn't it true that if Kim Beazley had confronted Howard more forcefully over the refugees, he would still have lost, but he would also still be leader and people would be joining the party, not leading, and you report, not leaving, and you report that the room broke into applause.
Yeah, that was, you know, it's sort of overdetermined now, I think, by, there was another, I don't know, people who watched Yes Minister will remember that there was a character in the first series who was the sort of prototype of the party hack, who'd snuck his way into the office and was despised by the public servants. And
I can see his face, but I can't remember his name.
Yeah, well, he got sort of ridden out of town. That was goodbye. But of course, in real life, he came back, and it was the Sir Humphreys and the rest who bit the dust. He came back with an army, and he's the Dominic Cummings and all those characters who've been running politics for the last 25 years.
I'm going to quote you again. In letting go a principled stand on refugees, Labor only continued the strategy of finessing their way back to power. They couldn't fool themselves that no choice existed or that they were the first to suffer savage opprobrium for their decisions. Evatt got as bad for opposing the bill to ban the Communist Party, call over Vietnam. Keating won an election with the Republic, reconciliation and a social democratic program on full show.
Yep, and I honestly think that Labor could do the same again, but I don't know whether there are still the believers in the party. I think there's a point at which somebody, of course, once said that Kim Beazley was the first leader of the Labor Party who didn't have a personality disorder, and to which I think most of his predecessors would have said, yeah, well, you need one to be in this game. Kim ought to get one.
Yeah. You've republished an essay, which I like, in praise of Tony Windsor. As a good poly, good enough to be the measure of what's missing in modern politics, what made Tony such a refreshing voice within the New England area, which happens to be where I dwell?
Yeah, well, I just thought that through all that rather, grueling period of Julia Gillard's government, that he was the man who sounded like he believed everything that he said, and that no one had told him to say it. And that he was a politician who practiced politics, not some other game. I thought he was just always that he was worth listening to. He didn't speak in sort of glorious Churchillian phrases. He spoke plain English, but he was worth listening to only because there was always substance to it. And that's what you find after a while. You think, well, I've listened to the politicians today and I don't remember anything they said.
You heard Windsor speak on the day that he and Oakeshott announced signing up with Julia Gillard, and he told the farmers of New England that they should give up their habitual allegiance to major Conservative parties and feeling hard done by all the time. And, of course, now we've got Barnaby.
We do. I was actually at a bull sale up your way in Walgett, actually, on the day that...
What are you at a bull sale for, God's sake? You can't have one in your back garden down there.
I was writing a book about the bush, and I thought I'd go to
Oh, that one, yeah.
They would have drowned him in the bar on that day. They were screaming shit about Tony, but it made no sense. It was just this sort of blind loyalty they had to the Nats and... I thought that's one thing that, I think the Labor Party, one of its big mistakes has been to ignore the regions. I think there was terrific potential in the regions and they just...
They had it. They had a few goes at it. Country Labor, do you remember?
Yes.
Was one example. Look, we're running towards the end and I want to talk about your final essay during these COVID times is on optimism, and it may come as a surprise to listeners to hear you say, optimism is a refuge of the scoundrel, like its thug relation, patriotism. Please explain.
Well, I think human beings need hope, but optimism is completely optional. If you want to be an optimist, you can, but it's not going to change anything. You can go off to war being an optimist, but it won't decide whether you get shot or not. And it's a kind of faux philosophy. It's a bit like I'm a glass half full person. I'm a glass half empty person. Well, I'm not either, I think if you look at what happened in the opening barrage of COVID, you had Johnson in England and Trump in America, and here, ever so briefly, with our own Prime Minister, saying, well, don't worry about it. I'm going to the footy on Saturday. You know, just wash your hands and sing happy. Not a problem. Not that problem. I'm very optimistic about this. But of course, COVID doesn't recognise optimism at all, as we soon found out. And thank God, here, science, which is a much better thing to believe in than optimism, was listened to. And so I think optimism is whereas hope is essential.
Well, not only is it essential, but it can work like hell. Look at Barack Obama's success with hope. But then, of course, as you point out, he gave his country back to Wall Street and chose optimism, and the country got optimism's incubus, Trump.
Yeah, that's exactly right, I think. It became, you know, one of the sort of Weasley words of politics and in public life. You're meant to be optimistic about this. You can be whatever you like if you just, it's, you know, it's a bit like that sort of faux Buddhist thing about living in the moment. It's lovely to live in the moment if it's a good moment. But if you're in a refugee camp in Darfur or someone, you probably would be better off trying to live in a moment that's imaginary. It's not the moment that you're living in. They're just sort of silly, kind of anodyne nonsenses, I think, that I wish politicians wouldn't use, and other people as well, including friends of mine. Or you're a glass half empty person, I think.
Let me quote you for our final moment together. Dark as these times may be, the pandemic has cast rare light on the powers that govern us in ordinary times and reveal them for what they are, performative claptrap, lies, a waste of time. We now listen to scientists, to science, to doctors. So do we have enough respect for science to take climate change seriously, Mr. Watson?
Well, I hope so. See, I have a feeling that, I hope, that the COVID thing here at least, in this country at least, and the negative example from many countries overseas, will persuade us in some strange way towards the virtues of science and reason and common purpose and communitarian feeling. I think all those sorts of things, which are not necessarily Labour values any more than they are old-fashioned conservative values.
So you have hope but not optimism?
I have hope but not optimism, yes.
Don, thank you so much for your time. The wondrous Don Watson, author, essayist, former speechwriter, and the latest book, which is very substantial, I'm just holding it up to the microphone, as is my practice. It's called Watsonia, A Writing Life, published by Black Ink, and I had no idea that they'd named a suburb after you, Don.
I used to play football against them. They were very dirty.
See you later.
Thanks, Phil. Cheers.
And that's it. On our next, we'll be back again with another extended chat with that marvellous writer, Martin Amis. And yes, we'll be talking about our mutual friend, Christopher Hitchens, among the topics. See you then.